This is Deanna Spingola. It is Thursday, July 5th, 2012, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is Bare Bones Broadcasting. My guest today is Veronica Clark. Her websites are veraiconapublishers.org and youtube.com/veraicona100. Alrighty. How are you today?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm good.
Okay. We'll have to let people know why we're laughing later.
Indeed.
Okay, so we're going to go ahead and just finish up our Crystal Knight talk. This will be the third and last one, and then we'll move on from here. Okay, so last time when we were talking about Ingrid Veckert's work in particular, we left off at the point where that Friedrich Christian, Prince of Schaumburg-Lippe, had been out in, I believe it was Sweden. Yeah, in Sweden. He had been like basically an adjutant of Goebbels's. So he was out of his own accord, very willingly out in Sweden, kind of passing the good word about National Socialism when the Crystal Knight occurred. And of course, he was furious about it because he felt that he was being undermined. You know, why did you send me to Sweden if you're going to have a pogrom that makes you look bad? So here's what happened. And this is by the prince's own account. When he walked into Goebbels' office, his presence went unnoticed and he overheard the propaganda chief in conversation with Count Heldorf. The chief looked furious. He's talking about Goebbels. His face was red. The whole business is outrageous, he lamented angrily. That is not the way to solve the Jewish problem, not by any means. Not that way. That only makes martyrs out of them. And then I am expected to bail us out of this idiocy, to iron everything out again with propaganda, an impossibility. We become unbelievable when we do things like that. Do you understand me? They have cut the ground out from under me. They have made me a laughing stock, end quote. So this is Goebbels lamenting to Count Heldorf and overheard by the prince. He then gripped his head, which Wilfried von Oven said he did when he was angry and distraught, and went on. We could not possibly have done the opposing propaganda a greater service. Our people have killed a dozen Jews, but for this dozen, we may have to pay someday with a million German soldiers, end quote.
Oh, how prophetic.
Uh-huh, a prophetic statement indeed. So, and of course, Goebbels didn't know the full extent at that time. So, you know, again, if he says a dozen Jews, well, this doesn't quite accord with his diary entry, where I believe he had written 17 Jews. Right. And it doesn't accord with the facts because it was either 36 or 91, depending on which source we consult. So, you know, as we know, Goebbels was certainly an opponent of the Jews and a steadfast one, but he kept his emotions in check with his intelligence. He would not have done something this stupid. And of course, his statements contradict his involvement. Of course, lest we overlook it, Kristallnacht occurred directly after the Munich conference and the Vienna arbitration. You know, Hitler was tiptoeing with France, trying not to, you know, make them angry or provoke them in any way.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, Alvin relates through which these two things, even the respect for Germany had reached its high point internationally. Everything depended on preserving the confidence that had been gained, end quote. So Germany's at the high point right now, and they go and do this. Doesn't
yes.
make sense.
Of course not.
Right. Okay, and then, of course, we have the David Frankfurter incident in 1936, the Jewish declaration of war, which there was one in 33, and then another one in 36. And then, lest we forget the Hindenburg disaster in 1937, so a year before. And many people, even today, suspect that a Jewish saboteur or a communist saboteur brought that blimp down.
Really?
That dirigible.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Everybody knew it was hydrogen. there is evidence, there is some circumstantial evidence suggesting that there was an incendiary on board.
Well, that's
suicide
what they
attacker.
Do. That's mm-hmm. what they do.
Exactly. So it was not, in fact, an accident. And on the, I believe that stuff is on the internet, so one can look into that. Just look up Hindenburg sabotaged or something like that, and it should come up. So again, we can't prove it without any doubt, but thinking about just provoking Hitler in Germany, it's certainly possible. And again, these would be many events along a continuum trying to provoke Germany to do some kind of action. And then, in fact, Goebbels had held his anti-Jewish propaganda campaign to a minimum in 1938, especially after these two events, when Germany's trying to, you know, get her standing up and not step on any toes. So why would he order a pogrom and at such a time? Kristallnacht was immeasurably awkward for him and the whole Reich leadership. So, indeed. You know, these are questions we have to ask ourselves. Most historians say it was Goebbels who set the synagogues afire. But is there, in fact, any proof for this accusation? No. So we're going to go through some of this. And, of course, why this? Why, like, a pogrom? What had happened? And how come no one ever demanded that the Kristallnacht receive its own independent investigation to bring its perpetrators to account? None of these people were investigated until 1948, 1946. I think there were some trials in 47. The main, like, head honchos, if you will, of this whole thing went down in 1948. And that would be Boehmker and this Lumpagel guy. Now, Wilf looked into this, I believe it's Heinrich Boehmker. I'm pretty sure it's Heinrich. This guy has been accused as being the one who made the phone calls.
Oh.
That Weckert couldn't identify what man it was. Well, he was the SA man and a mayor, as a matter of fact, and supposedly made the calls. He was the point man of Kristallnacht. The man committed suicide in 1944.
He committed suicide?
Allegedly. So he dies in 1944. Why? Who killed him? Did he in fact commit suicide? Huge questions there. And of course, if he was in fact the point man and the NSDAP was trying to hide this, why wait until 44? That doesn't make any sense.
Right.
So that kind of exonerates the NSDAP of taking him out to cover their hides. They would have done it much earlier. And then, of course, why did Rumpagel point him out as the point man? Because he was, Boehmker was Rumpagel's superior. And that is, in fact, who Rumpagel said he got his orders from. So he's implicating a dead man in 1948. We yes. still need to see that court transcript. So I'm going to have to leave that to a German person. So if they want the final say on that, or somebody does, they're going to have to get that Boehmker court transcript and find out what the verdict was, what the facts or the assumptions were, and who actually pointed fingers. Was it Rumpagel who implicated Boehmker? And was that to exonerate himself?
And where would those records be?
Those are at the IFZ. You cannot get that online, unfortunately. So I have the exact citation. Let me see if I can reach my book here. I might have to take my microphone off for a second. Where did I put that book? Okay, hold on one sec.
Sure. Well, this is very interesting. All of these facts together certainly makes it seem that Germany could not have done this. They would not have done this because it only made them look bad. And interesting.
Yeah. Okay, so looking through. This is in the Steinweiss book, so I'll give the full citation. It is Institut für Zeitgeschichte Munich, that's the IFZ, Urteil, SG Bremen, 11 February 1948, GB 11.06. So that's the citation, location, etc. If anyone has access to that, I think it's going to have to be a German because we were unable to obtain it through the IFZ on the internet.
Okay. Well, if there's anybody out there listening, that would be a wonderful thing to do.
Or if they could even just go there and look at it and write up a summary of it.
Right.
We don't even necessarily need the full thing verbatim. So that's basically what we've got on that. And then, of course, I ran that term Übung, which is like exercise or practice, past Wilfried, and he said no. That does not sound at all the correct term that Goebbels would use in the context referring to Kristallnacht. He wouldn't call it Übung. So, again, I think we're dealing with somebody who didn't know German well enough,
right,
who messed with his diary. So, moving on. Of course, again, these perpetrators were not brought to account until after the war by the West German courts, which weren't exactly the most
unbiased. Yes.
You know, unbiased, exactly. Definitely under Allied carefully watching eyes.
Sure, like the Nuremberg trials.
Exactly. And or at least to identify them with certainty. So, you know, we have guys who were basically trying to save their own skin tell the West German authorities whatever they wanted to hear. Yeah, it was Boomker. Well, mm-hmm. That guy died in 44. He can't defend himself. So, you know, that just doesn't fly.
Right.
Doesn't fly. So even Gleiwitz was investigated, and there was actually a post-war movie about it, but the Germans themselves investigated that. And we'll get into that later because that's an interesting story in itself. But so thanks to this post-war movie, you know, that caused the German government to seek out Alfred Naujoks in an effort to bring him to justice since he claimed responsibility for it at the IMT. So even Gleiwitz got like a formal investigation. Kristallnacht never did.
Huh.
So that's one of those things where we go, who didn't want to open that can of worms?
Right.
So, of course, before the Kristallnacht is very important. What about this Herschel Grünspan or Greenspan? The Polish government had decreed, and this is so important that people understand this, the Polish government, not Germany, decreed on October 6th, 1938, and then published an ordinance on October 15th, stipulating that all Polish passports must bear a control visa for their continued validation. Passports minus this visa were no longer valid for crossing into Poland. This meant that Polish Jews living abroad would not be allowed to return to Poland, even though it was their homeland. Thus, 70,000 Polish Jews on Reich territory would have to be permanently tolerated on German soil.
Well, now, that is very interesting. We usually hear that, you know, it's always the Germans that do everything.
Oh, yeah, they're always the ones that. This is put off. This little repatriation instigated by Poland, which we know that Warsaw had connections to Dr. Weizmann, who had connections to Paris and Mr. Lukács. And why would Warsaw do this? And what was Poland? Okay, so
right,
this is.
Right, exactly.
Right. Basically, to make the Germans look bad, because this is portrayed as Heydrich's first kind of mass deportation prelude to the Holocaust.
Yes.
So it's very important to debunk this. So that roundup in 1938 was Poland's doing. The German authorities acted quickly. This is no different than, I mean, today we look at, because we're in the United States and you just hand out citizenship like it's candy to any criminal that runs across your border, any murderer from another country seeking political asylum. We're really an insane asylum here as far as citizenship rights. But back then, nobody just automatically wanted, say, 70,000 foreigners to be automatically citizens and then given the rights of citizens, which would be welfare, you know, employment, etc. back then. So this was a big deal. So the German authorities acted quickly. We got 70,000 people that we don't necessarily want. Okay, so on October 9th, 1938, Werner Best and Himmler informed Dr. Lammers of this sudden Polish measure. The German embassy in Warsaw was then instructed to request that the Poles ensure that Polish Jews living in Germany be able to re-enter their homeland of Poland without the visa. The German government would also have to expel all Polish Jews as quickly as possible back to Poland. The passport ordinance went into effect starting on October 29, 1938. Thus, on the 28th and 29th, about 15,000 Jews, mostly adult males, were taken into custody in the whole of Germany for repatriation. Now, everyone acts like it was every Jew in all of Germany. No, it wasn't even the majority who were affected by this. But again, what was the goal? What was Poland's goal in doing this? All of a sudden, you're just going to have this visa ordinance to make it appear that Jews were suffering Nazi terror, arbitrary yes. terror. That's what I have deduced from this. So then we need to ask, okay, Poland, was it really the Poles behind this, or was it perhaps international Jewry behind it working through Poland? What might international Jewish interests, what might their goal have been with doing this? Again, it's to create sympathy, to create victims and martyrs of an evil, brutal system that is just out of control. That's constantly what they were trying to harp on with Germany. You know, this guy is out of control. He's a madman. Look at how he just rounds up these poor innocent Jews and then throws them out for no reason at all. This is how it was portrayed to the rest of the world. So, you know, it's just this crazy illusion we have of Germany that they were, you know, out of control mad dogs of persecution. So even though the ordinance went into effect only on October 30th, 1938, the Poles refused to allow their own citizens to return.
Oh.
They stopped at the border. Only 12,000 were successfully repatriated. This means that 3,000 were stuck on that border. And the Germans had to quickly arrange for their shelter, food, any necessities. That's really nice of Poland to do that.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, some of these people were successfully repatriated at border crossings. Some of them had to go through the woods and fields because their own country was, you know, standing there saying, don't come back. And yet, who hears about this about Poland? This is incredibly inhumane as far as I'm concerned, but we don't hear about it. So, you know, of course, the Germans are the evil ones. So had the border agents been instructed by Warsaw, and who in Warsaw, I must ask, to turn these Jews away? You know, they had been ordered to do so. By whom and why?
And the Germans were responsible for these 3,000 people who were stuck on the border. They had to feed and yep. house them?
Mm-hmm. And it just so happens that Greenspan's parents were among them, and this is supposedly why Greenspan went and just had to kill a German diplomat in revenge. But, of course, and I ask this question in the Hyenas of High Finance, if Germany was so horrible and such a terroristic Hades for Jewish people, then why would he want revenge for his parents being relatively humanely, for the circumstances, repatriated back to their homeland? That doesn't make sense.
Exactly. I mean, if he was going to be mad at anybody, it would have been a Polish diplomat.
Yeah. They were escaping the Nazi horror, right? That we're
sure.
all it's quote-unquote Nazi horror.
Sure.
So that doesn't even make sense as a motive.
Now, Greenspan was associated with the group in Paris.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's all circumstantial, but we'll get to that real quickly here. Basically, and here's another thing that undercuts the Greenspan accusation that he wanted revenge. These Jews would be allowed to return to Germany once they had updated their passports so as not to become stateless burdens to Germany. So all it was we're going to repatriate you real quick, deport you, get your visas updated because the Poles have pulled a fast one on us, and then come back. No big deal. And everyone made a Holocaust out of this. This is prelude to the Holocaust here.
Sure.
It's kind of insanity. So once again, and Weckert says this, the majority of Polish Jews who lived in Germany at the time were unaffected by this passport affair. So they had apparently already had the updated passports or were somehow able to circumvent this problem. So it was the majority of Polish Jews in the Reich weren't even affected by it. It was a small minority.
Right, right.
And then, of course, this whole affair was not provoked by NS Germany, but by Poland, which clearly had a hostile, perhaps deliberately hostile, policy toward Jews. Victims were not only Polish Jews living in Germany, but German Jews living in Poland that they were throwing back to the Reich.
Hmm.
Yeah. So this is really a strange thing. And, of course, somebody who's familiar with Polish would be... It would be very great if they could go into their archives and figure out who ordered this.
Indeed.
Get any motives deduced from the literature? It would be nice to know.
Right. So you need somebody in Poland.
Yeah. A German to look into the IFZ and a Polish person to look into this 1938 visa affair. And then, of course, the deportees were said to have been, quote, driven across the border into the machine guns of the Polish border guards, end quote.
Oh,
no. I mean, they're talking about blood flowing, whip slashing. Just there's a photo of this in the Wiener Library collection, which is all these pictures of, you know, alleged Jewish persecution and preludes to the Holocaust. And one of them is this border deportation. They're all just standing there, arriving on the trains. There's no whips. You can't even make out a German guard anywhere.
Hmm.
You know, this nonsense that they were being driven into the machine guns of the Polish border police. No, no. And they certainly weren't being whipped. We are also told that this deportation by Heydrich differed little from Auschwitz. Always. All lies, as we know. So, enter Herschel Grünspan. Among those brought to the border were young Herschel Grünspan's parents, brother, and sister. Herschel, a 17-year-old Jewish boy at the time, was living in Paris. His father, Zindel, had only recalled the horror of this border crossing thing 23 years later during the Eichmann trial in Jerusalem. Well, so he died. Say a word until the in the 1960s.
Yeah, 1961, my word.
Three was incredible after 23 years. It was just pinpoint perfect. Yeah, right. He claimed that the SS men whipped them and the Jewish blood flowed in the streets.
And
SS men carried pistols, Zindel, not whips. And everyone was well bundled for that time of the year. This was the end of October, after all, on the border. So blood would not have been, it would not have been flowing, but would have been absorbed by the heavy clothing.
Of course.
And it would most certainly have been worthless weapons in such circumstances. Heavily bundled people whipping them, not likely.
Right. Now, Herschel Grünspan, why was he living in Paris as a 17-year-old kid? That doesn't seem to be consistent with anything. Why would he be separate from his parents?
Let me jump to that part real quick. Oh, Hannah Arendt. Okay, she described him as a psychopath. And that, of course, was at the trial, the Eichmann trial. Herschel was not a good student. Hannah Arendt described him as a psychopath who was incapable of finishing school. His school reports were bad, according to the Paris court records, and his performance at Hebrew school was also unsatisfactory. He left Germany when he was just 15. He first went to various relatives in Essen, then to Brussels, Belgium, and finally to his uncle in Paris. He fell in with bad company there, was picked up in a police raid, and on August 15th, 1938, was ordered expelled from France. So then I asked the question, how did he buy the revolver then? He did not leave the country, even though he was officially expelled. He stayed on illegally without a residence permit, so he wouldn't have had any proper identification papers to go buy a revolver. And then, of course, he took a room in a small Paris hotel in the Boulevard de Strasbourg, one street away from his uncle's residence. Now, his uncle had nothing to do with any of this. They've cleared him. So the question is, who gave him the idea to go kill and who paid his bills?
Yes.
Yeah. Who did he go live with? That's a great question. Of course, Ingrid says it was the LICA and their affiliates.
Mm-hmm. And they always use good psychopaths whenever they find them.
Mm-hmm. And he did not express any remorse at all. He didn't run. He didn't flee. Nothing. Strange.
Yes.
Just be able to murder someone in cold blood, watch him dying there. And he allegedly said he should die. He should be dead now. What? It's a pity he's not dead, because he survived for a few days afterwards. So, you know, that kind of indifference, that's a psychopath for sure.
Yes.
Okay. So yeah, Dr. Friedrich Grimm, an internationally recognized legal expert, studied this intensively, this whole affair on this border. And he concluded that as bitter as the experience was for the targeted Jews, you know, nobody likes to be grabbed up and deported. That's not fun for anybody. It was humanely conducted nevertheless. The Germans did it as humanely as they could, given the circumstances. They didn't want just, you know, these 70,000 people, instant citizens. So, and of course, we got to think, back then, Hitler had his economic problems still, an extra 70,000 burden. You know, let's put ourselves in his shoes.
Sure.
So, of course, Zindel betrays himself again when he claims that everyone signed forms at Hanover Police Precinct 2, except for one man who he named as Gershon Silber, 23 years after the fact, at the Eichmann trial.
What a memory.
Exactly. Who remembers such things? He even dares to assert that Mr. Silber was forced to stand in a corner without moving for the next 24 hours.
That's...
What, did Sindel watch this man there for a day without falling asleep? No. Sindel left the station for the assembly point. He doesn't say where that was, just assembly point. Very vague. He doesn't remember those specifics. Shortly after he signed the form that he apparently hadn't even bothered to read. He described the forms handed out at the station as something or other. So you're handed this form and you're like, yeah, it's something or other. Okay, I'll sign it. Just the insanity. Okay, so we then encounter our first notable discrepancy in accounts. Zindel says many people were at the station, and another account says many hundreds were there. Well, how many was it? Some say it was 12,000 all there at once.
Oh, what a big station it must have been.
So, of course, Zindel's one of them. He then says that his transport arrived on the border on the night of October 28th, 29th. And so did trains from everywhere, according to Zindel.
All like, at one time. My goodness.
Listen, Bremen. He was apparently naming them off as they came in. Oh, that one's from Leipzig. That one's from Bremen. Wow, all over the Reich. Thousands of people in all, he recalls. How did he know all this at the time? Did he ask where the trains were from and count all 12,000 arrivals? No, he was obviously told this later or had read it and was perhaps even coached by the attorney to recall these details as though still fresh in his mind after 23 years.
Now, would Allied attorneys actually, or no, this was in 1961. Would the Israeli attorneys actually do this? No.
Especially not during the Eichmann trial.
Oh, goodness.
Adolf Eichmann, that must have been something else. Okay, so he then relates how, quote unquote, the Poles, he doesn't tell us which Poles, the border guards, we're not sure, called a Polish general. What? What did the Polish army have to do with border security? What was the general's name, and how did Sindel know he was a general? Who then admitted them, thanks to their, quote, special identification documents, to a village. He doesn't know which one. Of exactly 6,000 inhabitants. That he did know.
Wow.
The village Sindel failed to name was actually Bensian. So, you know, what admitted us to a village of 6,000 inhabitants? He was coached.
Of course he was.
Obviously. So, of course, the whole Eichmann trial is now undermined because of this insanity, and so is Kristallnacht along with it. He claims it was there that he wrote a letter, though some historians who apparently know better than Sindel himself say it was a postcard to Herschel in Paris. So, you know, oh, no, he doesn't know it. He doesn't know any better. It wasn't a letter. It was a postcard. So all of his other testimony is good as gold, but he wrote a postcard, not a letter. Fine. As the story goes, outraged Herschel goes out, buys a revolver, kills Ernst von Rath at the German embassy in France as an act of revenge. Of course, we've already asked, why did he want revenge for the quote-unquote evil Nazis deporting his parents back home from the anti-Jewish Nazi Hades? That's a good question. You know, doesn't make any sense. And of course, Sindel received welfare payments in NS Germany after 1933.
Really?
Fair.
Wow.
Hitler government. It just goes to show you. So this murder happened in Paris on the morning of November 7th, 1938. What were the details and the facts? We'll look at those now. So, seriously wounded by Glinspan, von Rath succumbed to his wounds, dying on the afternoon of November 9th, 1938. As we know, some of these spontaneous uprisings, etc., preceded the actual death. Whether or not those were really spontaneous, that's up in the air. Glinspan was immediately caught at the site by the French police, interrogated in Paris. Preparations for a judicial process were started. The French pursued their inquiry on several levels, by the police, investigating magistrate, finally by the doctors. Further inquiries were instituted by the German authorities. Everything was meticulously recorded by French investigators, including data on Glinspan's background and family. He came from Hanover. And yet, historians to this day are unable to agree what his father, Sindel Glinspan, did for a living. He was a master tailor, no, a bootmaker, no, a cobbler. No, actually, he was a mender, say the Paris court records, like his three brothers. They came from Poland to Germany and settled in Hanover. So, depending on which historian you read, we don't know what his father did. His father was out of work for a while, but received welfare, of course, from the Hitler government after 1933, totaling several thousand Reichsmarks. Whoops. And of course, we've already gone over that Herschel was not a good student, so obviously had a falling out with his family. Kind of strange that he would ask Herschel for some kind of assistance or let him know what had happened on the border, isn't it?
Yes.
His estranged son?
Yes, and especially since he was kind of a ne'er-do-well.
Yeah. Why did he write him? It's a little strange. Well, some people say it wasn't actually, some historians say it wasn't actually his father. It was the sister who wrote. So we can't agree on that either. The question now is, did either of them ever write?
Yes. And of course, all of these stories, I think, are probably very deliberate, because then nobody can make any conclusions at all.
Right. What we really need to ask ourselves is, did the sister or the father ever even write the kid? That's number one. Historians just automatically go, oh, the sister wrote, or oh, the father wrote, without going, wait a minute, maybe both of those are lies. I need to be looking elsewhere. It's like the cold case of the serial killer. You're looking at totally the wrong people, you know, the wrong suspects, and over here on left field is where you should be looking.
Right.
The kind of thing we need to start doing. And of course, how did he manage to live without means? Who paid his room, his meals, his maintenance? What did he do all day long? Historians have never answered any of these questions until Ingrid Wecker comes along. So as the story goes, he received word one day that his parents had been expelled from Hanover and were taken to Poland, their homeland. How did he get this news? By postcard from his father in Poland? No, it was a card from his sister. Wait a minute. Father Zindel said that he wrote a letter, not a postcard. Though 23 years had passed, he may have forgotten. But this still does not answer how young Greenspan got the correspondence. He received the card on November 3rd and was even said to have been moved by it, as though this historian was there to see
right.
him. It's kind of idiocy. How does the historian know? Was he in the room with him?
Exactly.
So how did he get it? Where was this post going to? Who was giving him his mail?
Exactly.
Legally. Apparently, he brooded for 4 days over this, and on the morning of the fifth day, it is now November 7th, he knows what he must do. He gets up early, leaves his hiding place, walks one block to the Rue Faubourg St. Martin, goes into an arms dealer, and buys himself a revolver. With whose money? And was it really a revolver, or was it a pistol, like some historians say? He had no identification, yet he was just sold a revolver? Did he know how to fire it? Where did he learn? None of these questions are ever even asked. Now, there is a book called Kristallnacht, The Unleashing of the Holocaust by Anthony Reed and David Fisher. They claim that the guy who sold the gun to him taught him how to shoot it right then and there.
Oh, wow. That's great that he was able to take lessons and learn that quickly.
I mean, what? This kind of is the gun dealer. And he's all, oh, and make sure you walk down to the police office. Yeah, go ahead and walk right down the street and register that gun, son. See you later. We need to start asking some serious questions here. So allegedly at 7:30 in the morning, he pockets his new weapon, continues walking to the German embassy, barely an hour's walk. He gets there at 8:30 a.m. No, wait, that's too early. 9:40 sounds better for some historians, which is shortly before office hours. The German ambassador was just leaving the grounds for his morning walk. No, wait, he was returning from his walk, say others. In any case, who cares about the details? The count was in the courtyard when Greenspan entered. He was the one who Greenspan asked to be directed to the German ambassador, and who, thinking Greenspan was on some routine business, sent him to the bureau chief Nagorka, and then Nagorka then sent him to see von Rath. So then the murder's committed. Yet no historians actually know how Greenspan did it or where he was standing when it happened, or even how many shots were fired. Was it 2, 4, or 5? Some even claim that he said, quote, I am a Jew and have come to avenge the Jewish people. No, wait, that was David Frankfurter that said that when he murdered Wilhelm Gustloff in Switzerland. They had the exact same quote.
Wow.
Fisher say that he called him a German pig dog. I know who it's or whatever. You know, what did he say? No one knows. No one was there. It was just Greenspan in von Rath. And one of them died. So all we can go on is what Greenspan says. And of course, he changed his story a million times. So here we go. The French police report claims that Greenspan's murder motive was the wrong done his parents by NS Germany. But that doesn't make any sense. Why would his parents be upset at their repatriation back to their homeland? Besides, their detention and repatriation was humanely conducted, and they could re-enter the country once their visas were updated. This is what Greenspan had said at his initial questioning, that he wanted revenge. But later on, he withdrew from this line. It was an accident, he said. The automatic pistol went off by itself.
It just happened to have it pointed at von Rath.
The perfect location. Why not the clock on the wall?
Right.
And then, of course, no, I only wanted to kill myself. I hated him. Okay. And then, last but not least, I no longer know how it happened. I think the gun just went off by itself. Kind of
sure.
It always does. He couldn't remember at all. He had acted under hallucination. This is precisely what happened with David Frankfurter. Said the same thing. Accident, no, hallucination, almost identical. Big questions there. Why do they have almost the same defense strategy? Okay, so, you know, this is exactly what Frankfurter said after the murder of Wilhelm Gustloff. Might that have anything to do with LICA's Leica's involvement or the involvement of Vincent Moro Giafferi? So we'll come back to these two later. Moving along, not even Hannah Arendt bought this revenge defense line, while Greenspan's brother remained reticent about it at the Eichmann trial. Hannah suspected that he was a tool of a group still not identified, so even she thought, no way, this kid was used. This happens to be what Dr. Friedrich Grimm, who the Jewish historians describe as a Nazi attorney, thought about the David Frankfurter case, which went down on February 4th, 1936. Grimm said, quote, "The whole manner of his defense, his preparation for the deed, indicate that he was only a tool, that the instigators were to be sought elsewhere. There was strong circumstantial evidence implicating people around the Leica." So Frankfurter ended up going to Israel and lived on reparations money paid him by the West German slave state. This in spite of the fact that he had murdered an NSDAP official. Frankfurter gets off, isn't brought to justice. Greenspan ends up changing his name, getting new papers, and living on in Paris. He was never killed either.
Oh, that's very interesting.
So he ended up surviving the war, presumably in a German prison cell. That's pretty amazing. And then his parents, of course, end up in Israel. I believe it was the American Joint Distribution Committee that helped repatriate them to the new Jewish state. So, you know, none of these people really suffered.
No.
Just incredible. So, of course, we're always told Goebbels probably had a hand in the Greenspan case, though some have actually screamed a resounding yes to this. The NS basher Grommel conceded that, quote, "there is no evidence for this version at all." So even this Grommel, who's like a very prominent German historian, he had to concede, no, there's no evidence. Historians simply say it because they can get away with it. No one bothers to check because, after all, who wants to defend, quote unquote, evil Nazis? There aren't that many people out there that are willing to put their reputation or whatever on the line for the NSDAP. We're a rare breed. So, you know, they figure no one's going to check.
Yeah, I was just looking up this, the book that you mentioned, Kristallnacht, The Nazi Night of Terror and the Unleashing of the Holocaust. And there's one review. And it says, "I found this book to be well-written and very informative. Unfortunately, I have since come upon identical passages in an earlier work called On Borrowed Time by Leonard Mosley." And that's the only review that it has.
There you go. I think that has a comment or something. And I guess these historians had quoted so extensively from that Mosley book that it could almost be considered plagiarism.
Yes.
You know, you're supposed to be limited on the amount you can actually quote from a book. But, you know, it's not that well written. I've already found some huge problems and I just started it. So, you know, just a bunch of nonsense. But, you know, real quick, before we run out of time, the whole Greenspan thing, I think that's pretty much laid to rest. I mean, this kid is a psychopath, changing his story from one minute to the next, was never actually even, you know, tried by the NS state. He just sat out the war in a prison cell. They say that the NSDAP killed him, but there is zero evidence supporting that. And there is circumstantial evidence supporting that he lived on in Paris under a new identity. Now, the Jews have done damage control on that, and they issued a journal article about this going, no, that didn't happen. And I think that's even in the Steinweiss book. I don't buy it. Show me this journal article.
Right.
Bunch of Jewish sources saying that he didn't, in fact, carry on in Paris after the war. I just buy it. And why is it exclusively published in a journal? Let's get that information out there, Steinweiss. Come on, give us a synopsis about it.
Sure.
So, you know, that's on him to produce that. Ingrid's convinced that he lived on in Paris. But real quick, this wonderful book by Mitchell Bard, 48 Hours of Kristallnacht, Night of Destruction, Dawn of the Holocaust.
Yes.
Really cute little gems in here. For example, these are some of the oral testimonies. Dr. Harry Stern was the president of the local lodge of B'nai B'rith in Erfurt. Now, wait a minute. You're telling me that there was a local B'nai B'rith lodge still in existence in Erfurt in 1938?
Hmm.
This is the kind of stuff they accidentally reveal in these Shoah, you know, the online Shoah testimonies.
Right. And we know how credible those are.
Oh, yeah. There's thousands of these things. And you're going, how bad was Kristallnacht when you were 5 years old? And of course, this whole book is oral testimonies. Every one of these people was a small child, 5 years old, 7 years old, 13 years old, 12 years old, 6 years, you know, whatever. They all remember. Exactly. In fact, they even have the political agenda of the NSDAP down.
Amazing.
I mean, come on. You guys were children. This is insane. And they keep saying that, you know, my father was arrested and taken to Dachau or taken to a concentration camp or Buchenwald or whatever. Okay, so I said, all right. I'm going to just look on a map that's to scale and see how reasonable that is. Now, keep in mind, a lot of these people were allegedly these adult males. Okay, first of all, this was in violation of the alleged telexes that are in fact fake that went out on Heydrich and Müller's orders, even though Müller didn't have the authority, that they said only arrest affluent Jewish males. So, and they had to be older. I don't remember specifically what the telex said, but older, affluent, mature. You know, we don't want youngins. Well, apparently the SA was arresting all the wrong people because they had young boys and teenagers and young adults. They were all flooding into the prisons and the concentration camps, according to the oral testimonies. So right here, just because they published a book on the oral testimonies, they've undercut the telexes. They don't think about these things when they publish them.
Right.
So thank you, Mr. Mitchell Bard. You've done us all a favor, actually. So I took this map. This is the Kristallnacht, the nationwide pogrom, November 9th and 10th, 1938, map to scale. This is available on like the Holocaust Memorial Museum.
Of course.
Yeah. Of course, they have every dot here of their persecution. So one account said that the arrest was, it took place in Mannheim. Of her father or brother or whatever it was, to Dachau. Now I said, okay, well, from Mannheim to Dachau is nearly 200 miles. Okay, so you're going to arrest this guy, take him 200 miles within, what, 13 hours or so, and then go, oh, we don't really need you here. You're dismissed. They released the majority of these people taken into protective custody the next day. So you just wasted 400 miles.
And a lot of time and a lot of everything else.
Exactly. Transporting one guy. Here's another one. From Karlsruhe to Ludwigshafen to Dachau. Over 100 miles. You know, why do we need to go from Karlsruhe to Ludwigshafen? Why do we need to go from one city to the next and then on to Dachau? What was that all about? Doesn't say. Just did it. And then another account, this person was transported from Regensburg to Dachau, which is about 100 miles, released the next day kind of a thing. From Wiesbaden to Buchenwald, this is another one, 220 miles approximately.
You know, the average person is not going to do this.
220 miles? Why not put them in a local jail cell?
Of course.
Well, of course, some of the Jews say they were put in the local horse barn or an assembly point or a racetrack or whatever. I'll bet if people start looking into these things and going, wait a minute, is there in fact a stable that existed at that time in this city? Was there you know, this certain jail, the problem with these accounts is they never give you a name. They tell you to the local jail. What jail? Which one? That they never tell you. And there's a reason they leave that out. It's because they cannot corroborate this. And every one of these oral testimonies has a different account of something. And I caught one lady, she gives her personal account, and then another person says that she was a witness of what they saw.
In a different area?
Well, not in a different area, but different accounts of what actually took place.
Oh, okay.
Fired between her and the local German residents. In one account, she's pro-German. In the other account, she's anti-German. So she says, yeah, they were, you know, acting like creeps, like animals, you know, what they deserve. That's allegedly what the German said. And in the other account, she says the Germans were kind and weren't quite sure, you know, what was going on and felt bad. Well, which one was it? You got two different accounts here now. Somebody said one thing about you, and now you're saying another thing on your own account. Which one's true?
Right.
See, again, they just don't think about these things. And then I have one more here. From Austria to Buchenwald. Okay, so Vienna is where allegedly a whole bunch of Kristallnacht activity took place. Well, if you go to from Vienna to Buchenwald, you're looking at about, I believe that was 230 miles. And then from Austria to Dachau, about 200 miles. Why not just send him to a camp or a jail in Austria? Why would you cross the border into Germany?
Does not make sense.
Not make sense to me at all. I realized that, you know, Austria was reunited with the Reich, but come on.
Certainly they had jails in Austria.
Yeah. Why would you do that? That just doesn't make any sense. So, and of course, the whole, you know, the whole case doesn't make any sense.
Well, they have to give notoriety to these prisons and bring in to give some sort of, to say, oh, Dachau was terrible and they took us to this concentration camp. And it just corroborates some other lie that people have told.
Exactly. And then, of course, just finishing up on Grünspan here real quick. Of course, we still have some unanswered questions, and this is why the case is still circumstantial. With whom was Grünspan connected in Paris? Who provided for his maintenance after he was ordered expelled by the French police? Who gave him the money for the revolver? And where did he get the idea to murder a German official? For that matter, who gave Frankfurter the idea? Say, his uncle had nothing to do with any of this. What we do know is that Grünspan had not lived with his uncle since August 15th, 1938. Instead, he rented a room in a small hotel on the Boulevard de Strasbourg, but he did visit his uncle almost daily, and in the process, he walked past an old Parisian apartment house with a sign on the right, next to the entrance door reading LICA. So he passed this every single day. Apparently, he did more than just walk past the building, since Paris attorney Vincent de Moreau Giaferi had announced at the police station, okay, not even waiting for the trial, the police station, that he was assuming Grünspan's defense. He had connections to Leica, and so did Bernard Cache, whom we've already looked into, who had connections with Weizmann, who had connections in Warsaw. So was this Polish visa affair somehow connected with Leica?
Well, circumstantial or not, this certainly looks like a probability.
Yeah.
A very likely probability.
Exactly. And of course, you know, everyone goes, well, you know, the Jews were being persecuted and they declared war on Germany. No, 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 no. They declared war on Hitler Germany, and they always say Hitler Germany, Hitler Deutschland, before anything actually happened, before the Nuremberg Laws, before the Supplementary Decree, before anything actually happened, they had already declared war.
Right. And he didn't even make any reference to the Jews in the first 6 months of when he came to power.
Right. So who was the agitator? You know, I'm saying it. Now, This is prophetic, and it's important that people hear this, because this is, Hitler really is our problem today because of this, and here's why. In this declaration, the Jews said, quote, Germany may be called on to pay a heavy price for Hitler's antagonism to the Jews, end quote. Now, mind you, it's the Jews who are being antagonistic. This heavy price is still being paid today. In fact, since March 24th, 1933, Hitler's antagonism to the Jews has served as the centrum of German post-war history and European and American post-war political culture. Everything we do is centered around Jewish suffering because of Hitler, and we must understand this. If you do not knock down this pillar, and the pillar that Hitler was this genocidal racist, which he was not, we will never, ever, ever be able to be sovereign ever again. The entire West, Europe, America, Britain, it doesn't matter who you are, you will not be sovereign. You will forever be guilty, and we are going to continue to bow down to any injustice done to us because of these lies. So everything centers on whether or not a country is anti-Jewist, I say, like Hitler. This is why nations literally crawl over each other to please the Jutsis today, because they know what happened to Hitler in Germany as a result of his defiance against Jutsis.
How true.
Yes, it was not antagonism. It was defiance against a hostile world order that literally had people groveling for jobs. Why do we think today that they just literally on a whim can crash an economy? Look at what the American government, Goldman Sachs, has done. Just Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs is the reason for the Greek collapse. Goldman Sachs, this one bank. Just the whole Federal Reserve Consortium is responsible, solely responsible with the Bank of England for this whole crisis. And yet, none of us can say a thing for fear of the Jews.
Exactly.
What happened to Hitler.
Wow.
Yeah. And well, I mean, relentless with those Germans.
Certainly. And that's the example. And that's the example that they always use.
Right. That's why they go after us with such a vengeance. I have a friend, my webmaster, who tries to write reviews on Amazon. They somehow know that he's tied to me, that, you know, we're somehow affiliated, because they struck down every single one of his reviews, every one of them. There were about 40. He had a review on your book, in fact, took that off, too.
Wow.
Find Amazon, and they really watch out.
It is amazing how they seem to be so networked together that they can oversee all of these things, the reviews.
Uh-huh.
How can they do that?
They're little Hawkeyes. And of course, I've tried to get Garrett Phillips' review removed. Because it's just a nasty review. You got to read that last paragraph. That's profane, to say the least. It's just nasty and profane and vulgar. They will not remove it. And I have literally had 3 or 4 people submit that as against the guidelines. They said this does not violate guidelines at all.
And so, oh, my goodness. So their guidelines are obviously very selective.
Exactly. Because here's what I had my webmaster post that exact same review on another book, only it was slightly adjusted to apply to this other book. It's been removed twice for violation of guidelines. They will not remove it from mine. So, you know. And I'm talking about Black Nazis 2, the 2010 release. It has 5 reviews, and one of those is from Mr. Katz, and then the other one is this Phillips guy. They will not take it down. And I thought, that's really cute, because you took it down twice before when it had almost verbatim wording for violation of guidelines. So what are your guidelines? And I asked them that, and they said they could not answer me. They said, we can't give you an answer. I don't understand. And I even called them on the phone.
Really?
Yeah. And I'm like, well, you know, that's Amazion for you. We call it Amazion now. And you know, if you just look at the discussion forums there, you have anything that's revisionist, it will immediately be pulled down as a violation. And you can have as much pro-Israeli, pro-Zionist, pro-Palestinian genocide discussion on there as you want, and it'll never be touched. They just get away with it with impunity.
Incredible.
Anyway, it's the same case with their books. They figure no one's ever gonna look into any of this. They don't care about justifying Hitler or exonerating anybody.
Course not.
Right. Very few people care that much about the NSDAP. So.
So I guess it's easy to target those few that do care or who
Ex
are trying to tell the truth.
exactly. And then you're a quote unquote Nazi or a fascist if you go, wait a minute here. Maybe these people were the good guys and everyone else was the bad guys. Or most of them. Let's start looking at this. Let's start inverting this relationship and looking at what really happened here, because as we know, we have inherited quite a nasty world order.
Certainly.
I don't think this is quite what America's people fought for, what we have now. So we need to start asking these questions. And of course, I challenge Alex Jones or anybody else who bashes and trashes Hitler, what would you do to get power and to get control back? Would you do different than what Hitler did? That's what I'd like to know. I want them to answer that question. How would you do it? I want to know how they'd go about getting that power back. And if they think that they can be nice to the Jews and just kind of assimilate them and incorporate them, well, that's already what Britain and America have done, and look at where we are.
Right. Or marry them even.
Yeah, we've never persecuted Jews, except for General Grant trying to expel them, which was shot down very quickly by Abraham Lincoln. Thank you very much, Lincoln. That was really the only case where Jews were officially persecuted.
And that didn't last very long. Excuse me.
Lincoln almost immediately, no way. That was immediately thwarted. And there's a book about that when
Right.
Grant expelled the Jews. I've got a couple articles about that on the site. So, we've done that already. We've done the assimilation, nice treatment thing. Look at where it's got us. Look
Right.
at the relationship between the United States and Israel. I'm not seeing a lot of reciprocity going on between the two countries.
There's none. There's absolutely none. Yeah.
One sided. Yeah. So this is what I want Alex Jones et al. To think about. How would you do it?
Well, the next time that I'm talking to him, I'll ask him.
We should. We got to ask him. How would you do it? Because I guarantee you he's going to say we got to do the same thing Hitler did. The thing is, to Hitler's credit, he was very restrained and he methodically just wanted to go through and squeeze the Jews with legislation. And it was that 1938 event where he said, gosh, I've got to step this up. I'm
Right.
being pressured now. So Hitler was feeling the pressure, but he was trying to do it as humanely and lawfully as possible. So I'm not going for this. He was this madman and genocidal and this and that. No. And of course, we must ask too, why did the Jews write so many books on him?
Oh my word, there's more books on Hitler than just about any other person in history.
We should ask the question, what is it that the Jews see in him that's so threatening or so interesting?
Yes.
Question. And I guess that's all I have for today.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I really appreciate all of your scholarship. Excuse me, I've run out of water. So it must be time to go.
Yeah.
All righty. Well, let's do this next week, too.
Okay, we shall.
All righty. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.